Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm delighted to be here. I've always had the utmost respect for the English department at this university, and after having arrived on a blissfully lovely day, such a contrast to the frost belt where I come from and now today, I'm in awe. How do you get anything done in this environment? Yeah, you see, as a creature of the environment, I would be led hopelessly astray. I need to be held to the frozen Puritan North. This talk with the hubristic title, Environmental Memory and Planetary Survival, derives from work that's still in progress in early stages on the forms, stakes, and larger implications of the distinctly memoirish cast of a lot of environmental writing, not just in the U.S., but near as I can tell, worldwide. For those of you not in literature studies, I'll try to give some sense of what this project might offer by way of interdisciplinary hooks, exchange, and also beyond academe to public discourse about environmental concern. And for those in literature studies, hope to suggest some directions eco-criticism has going or might go in relation to the rest of the field. For me, I'm hoping very much for feedback. Now, help me get to the next level of thinking through this tricky, multifold, consequential set of issues that are entailed and coming to terms with how artistic acts, literature especially for my purposes, create environmental memory. A few words about key words before launching in. Environment, memory, these are notoriously elastic terms used in multiple discrepant senses that could take a whole book to talk through. Environment, definable either with a tilt towards the sociocultural surround or to the material. And within that, the material surround, either toward the human built, the architectural or design environment, or toward the other-than-human realm of earth, air, water, life forms. These two senses of material environment, footnote, co-evolve, actually. To my knowledge, the first usage, OED says this, of environment in the noun sense is early industrial revolution, Carlyle, its introducer, and I think that's a kind of barometer of the co-evolution of the two sides of environmental materiality. More could be said about that back history, but I forge on. Memory. First, environment can denote widely different spatial scales, too, from the minute to the planetary. Memory can tilt either towards the individual person, whether to mean cognitive science, phenomenology of perception, or more traditionally, mnemonic devices or disciplines that enable recall, or can tilt towards so-called collective memory of social groups. As such, memory distinguishes from history either as complement or antagonist or both, depending upon your persuasion and the nature of the exemplum. But to cut to the chase for today, I'll be using memory mainly in relation to artistic acts of simulated recollection that thereby inevitably reinterpret and in some sense enhance and or critique empirical findings. And by environment, I'll mean in principle the entire cultural material surround at any spatial scale, but especially the material and most especially the so-called natural environment. I say so-called to acknowledge that long since the natural world has been anthropogenically impacted and altered. By environmental memory, a term yet seldom used and with no canonical usage. I'll mean awareness, whether idiosyncratic or socially shared, whether accurate or not, of environments at whatever scale in the fourth dimension. In particular, of humans and life forms more generally as embedded within webs of shifting environmental circumstance that stretch back into prehistory and forward into futurity. So all this in three parts, four parts. Parts one and three, mapping three sites of literary practice, three arenas having to do with ecosystems, lifelines, communities, imagination of those. And fourth and finally, some macro reflections on uses and abuses of environmental memory. One, ecological memory. The wildlife biologist often called the father of American environmental ethics, Aldo Leopold, once wrote, "To be an ecologist is to live alone in a world of wounds." Well, the specific concern here was, of course, the plight of the conscienceful scientist, distressed at omnipresent land abuse and shrinking biodiversity that his neighbors don't seem even to notice. But how does he register that concern? Through eloquence, through affect, through metaphor. And so, too, with a book by which, since his death, he's become best known over the last half century, Sand County Almanac, a classic of modern nature writing whose first and longest section centers on an abandoned farmstead bought during the Depression years as part family retreat, part environmental restoration project. One way this book gives weight to what might otherwise seem trivia, sawing wood, tree planting, bird watching, etc., is to expand the scope of memory from pre-settlement to the now. Toward the start, spinning out a mini-narrative of Wisconsin history in reverse while sawing through the rings of a bur oak tree that sprouted in the middle of the last century before statehood. Later on, retelling the story of aggressive marsh draining in the upper Midwest that's shrunk down wildlands and migratory bird populations almost to vanishing point. Through moves like these, the implied reader gets defined both as sympathetic witness and hopefully remorseful legatee of the one-sided co-evolution of settler and land. One of the paradoxes of eco-literature is how first-person centric it tends to be, often cast as the experience of an autobiographical persona, sometimes a we, versus how attitudinally and polemically it critiques anthropocentrism. Indeed, never in any of its genres does this anthropocentric element, the lens, reduced to zero, even when the author presents as a philosophic biocentrist, as Leopold does. To theorize, of course, in this vein, self-evidently requires a presiding consciousness. So that's the technical explanation, short form. "Who will speak for animals?" asks Chickasaw poet Linda Hogan, knowing perfectly well that no human can, yet convinced that human speakers must. Well, the contradiction makes more sense if, like this poem and Sand County Almanac, one sees that such speech acts are made as affirmations of non-human environment as integral to human lived experience over time. They need not, those affirmations, come out sounding preachy or self-focused, though. Here, for instance, is how Osage writer John Joseph Matthews, sometimes called the Native American Thoreau, frames his experiment in solitary cabin living in the 1930s and 40s, 10 years duration as against Henry David's 2 and a fraction. So he beat him by a factor of 4. Long before I came to the blackjack as an insignificant bit of life, made powerful by a birthright resulting from man's progress through the centuries. The ridges had no topographic importance, but were a part of high lands capped either with sandstone or a later member of the Carboniferous limestone, now a part of the Mississippi Delta, or resting on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. Goes on, geologic reminiscence. Well, language like this creates a sense of immense vista, historical as well as spatial, that solemnizes partly by the way that the speaker makes himself almost disappear, miniaturizing himself as an insignificant bit of life situated in a landscape made big by the expansions of time and scale, with the human yardstick quietly dismissed in that quickie allusion to topographic importance that isn't really specified. Writing at the same moment as Leopold during and right after World War II, and as an elder of an embattled remnant people on whose behalf he dutifully spends a big chunk of each year lobbying on Capitol Hill, Matthews is no less aware of the world's woundedness, of how the Amer Europeans, as he calls them, ran berserk on the new continent. If his prose seems to shut history out, that's because of its underlying sociobiological conviction that not just this generation, but all of Homo sapiens still stands at a primitive stage of evolution, bound to a process of natural selection and organismic life cycle that has to operate much the same way for all species, like it or not. With weird sounding but rigorous self-consistency, he again and again uses the epithet ornamental to mark the fancifulness of any thought or action that would tempt you to feel otherwise, himself included. He readily admits to, for example, listening to radio broadcasts of football and opera, but immediately belittles this as ornamental compared to the biotic limits within which his mind-body lives out its life. Well, this makes for a very different sort of environmental memory work from Leopold's. Leopold, wanting to correct against careless human degradation of natural systems, puts front and center the persona of the anxious conservationist who models good stewardship, as in, whoever owns land has thus assumed, whether he knows it or not, the divine functions of creating and destroying plants. Or, conservationist must be humbly aware that with each stroke he is writing his signature on the face of the land. Whereas Matthews, no less convinced that humanity is but one member of a much larger community of beings, opts for a cheerful fatalism, hopeful that the species may become less destructive, but certain that it cannot evade the workings of evolutionary law. The historian Simon Schama complains in Landscape and Memory that works of environmental history always undermine what's most original about them. That is, assigning the land and climate the kind of creative unpredictability conventionally reserved for human actors by predictably dismal plots in which the environment always loses. Interesting diagnosis. Well, he's right about the plot, but not about the complaint, seeing as how planetary history since industrialization, anyhow, has been a history of accelerating anthropogenic impact. But environmental literature, as an art of memory making or evocation, isn't bound to just that one plot. To paraphrase Giles Gunn, who alas is not here to tell me I traduced him, aesthetic texts are as if statements that hold promise of expanding readers' vistas by pressing the contrast precisely between the is and the might be. They can build, for example, on the biocentric premise of necessary human interdependence with land, either in the Leopold direction or the Matthews direction. Or for that matter, in other ways entirely, as with ecotopian science fiction's thought experiments with alternative worlds, like Ursula Le Guin's novella, Vaster Than Empires and More Slow. A crew of astronauts confronting an unknown planet comprised of a network of sentient plants of global scope. Le Guin's teasing out, I take it, some of the implications here of bioengineer James Lovelock's theory of Earth as a single holistic macroorganism, which he insists on calling Gaia, after the Greek goddess, to the delight of neo-pagans, but the perplexity of many scientists who have since forced Lovelock into a lot of hedging qualification, rejoinder, reframing around the question of the exact nature of Gaian being. How much significance, if any, to attach to the personification except as a catchy metaphor for a biomechanical process? Well, a novelist like Le Guin can cut through all that stuff by concocting a thought experiment that imagines insouciant human alienation from planetary holism without getting bogged down in the technicalities. This flexibility to frame alternative scenarios for environmental memory is really one of art's strongest suits, I think. Nor does science fiction or any fictive genre have a monopoly on this. New Zealand ecologist Jeff Parks' Ngā Aurora, The Groves of Life, to take one example and make it stand for all, following the path of the author's sorties into remnant wildlands, shuttles back and forth constantly along time bands from prehistory to Eurocontact to the now, between divergent settler and first people's voices that are mutually and also internally divergent, and panning out and back in scale from this or that rare plant in front of him to its distribution throughout Polynesia and the intertwined natural history of its migration here and its uses as foodstuff by human and by animal. This is a thought experiment based on the premise that the unlikely but possible survival of the sense of native plants, soils, climactic cycles, and life forces as necessary ingredients of how we actually live is certain to be, and this is his language, as much a matter of spirit and ritual as of ecology and policy. And the ritual that he has in mind here isn't Maori traditionalism. It's the kind of inventive conjuring from fragments that the book itself performs. Now, if there's such a thing as a critical discourse of re-enchantment, a book like this is it. You can figure out whether you think that's an oxymoron. Meanwhile, part two, environmental memory as extension of personal being. Most literary evocations of environmental memory don't arise from philosophic biocentrism, but simply from a view of environmentality as crucial to humanness. That persons and cultures fashion themselves in transactions with environments over time. Such work positions itself against the inertial effects of a cultural amnesia, arguably never stronger than now. The architectural historian Malcolm Quantrill puts this case very starkly. Technologized cultures seem condemned to a fixed moment in time, a sort of eternal present that has no meaningful reference to history, determined to wipe out the art of memory altogether, intent upon inventing the world de novo. He especially deplores the promiscuous deletion of history's traces from the built environment via big-scale tract, mall, and urban projects, and the preemption of slow-paced, walking-speed, ground-level movement in space by fast-paced automotive, aerial, and vertical up-and-down movement in skyscraper elevators. He really has a thing about elevators. The lead architect of Boston's transformation in the 1960s of a raffishly downscale but richly historic district into the glitzy new government center complex once asked, "Why dwell on a lurid memory?" A rhetorical question, he thought. Well, for Quantrill, that's fighting words. As an antidote, he lays out a how-to guide for the would-be reconnaissancer, especially of old cities with multiple historic layerings, to help one fashion a robuster environmental memory from the ruins of what's been partly obliterated. And that's what makes his book more, I think, than a predictable Jeremiad huffing against the regime of postmodernism. You know, after venting, he basically concedes, yeah, that's the way we live now, but here's a survival kit to help you deal with what's been sacrificed. A similar diagnosis of environmental memory loss vis-a-vis the non-human world is offered by developmental psychologists, anthropologists, environmental educators, who've been alarmed by the symptoms of attenuated existential contact with the natural world, particularly among children. Reviewing this work, the environmental journalist Richard Louv coins the term nature deficit disorder to mark the foreshortening of mental horizons and consequent possible long-term risks, not only for environmental memory as such, but also, he argues, for mental and physical well-being. If you curtail a kid's chances to roam free in wild places. Well, it remains to be seen if attenuated or enhanced contact with the natural world correlates significantly with uptick or alleviation of, say, autism or attention deficit disorder, as exposure to plants, natural scenes, or even images of nature has been shown to promote healing from illness or surgery, at least marginally, hopefully. But at all events, anxiety about this is an old and familiar refrain in literary history, as my literature colleagues know, and so too it's witness to the salubrious effects of renewed contact in adulthood with natural landscapes known in childhood. Wordsworth's poems of romantic recoil against urbanism through memory work triggered by return to earlier rustic haunts made this disposition canonical 2 centuries ago at the dawn of Industrial Revolution. Thoreau encapsulates this form of environmental memory workings in a journal entry from the first excited summer of his Walden experiment that later gets absorbed, though changed, into the book itself. 23 years ago, when I was 5 years old, I was brought from Boston to this pond, away in the country which was but then another name for the extended world for me. One of the most ancient scenes stamped on the tablets of my memory, the Oriental Asiatic Valley of my world, whence so many races and inventions have gone forth in recent times. That woodland vision for a long time made the drapery of my dreams, that sweet solitude my spirit seemed so early to require, that I might have room to entertain my thronging guests. Somehow or another, it at once gave the preference to this recess among the ponds, as if it had found its proper nursery. This goes a long way towards explaining why Walden, why there, and why make such a big deal out of Walden's symbolic luminosity, highlighting as it does the magnetism of this particular place from early childhood. Throughout both Thoreau's journal and the book Walden, you find scores of other passages that anticipate going there or return to it after the sojourn in body or in dream. Its specialness as an imagined place in the book and its power to infect the environmental memories of the thousands worldwide who have since pilgrimage there or devised neo-Walden experiments of their own, including, incidentally, my own paternal grandmother. I can say more about that later. Arises from the earliness and durability of its imprint as the dream place, the Oriental Asiatic Valley of my world, instilled at a time of life when, at least in the remembrance, no firm distinction existed between country space and personal space. Other writers spell out more the cumulative working of such memories over time, how what the child experiences later returns metamorphosed and in layers. Like early 20th century Scots novelist Neil Gunn's Highland River, an autobiographical text about growing up in a paradigmatic working class coastal community. And here's a passage from it. The river became the river of life for Ken, this 9-year-old boy. He never approached it but with some quickening of breath or eye. When his years had doubled and he was a soldier in France, he could more readily picture the parts of it he knew than the trench systems he floundered amongst. In zero moments, I'm not sure what zero moments are, but go figure. In zero moments, it could rise before him with the clearness of a chart showing the main current of his nervous system and its principal tributaries. Not that there was any suggestion of undue obsession by it, quite the contrary. Yet in one vivid moment, it could produce that brightening of the eye that is more than the smile that follows, intimate and yet aloof, like something half remembered and with the quality of loneliness about it that is perhaps more native to man's essential nature than any other quality, and that visits him finally with a strange new dignity before death. Three stages of consciousness here intertwine. The boy's excitement, the soldier's compensatory displacement of the labyrinthine trench, and the narratorial framing which both qualifies that displacement as a flicker, not a constant, and further solemnizes the primal landscape as a definer of personal being. I should say the years after return of the mental map of the river system in the trench, it's more than a nostalgic flashback to natural rambles of childhood. Since the original place imprint, stressed earlier, was intensified by the sense of danger at poaching on forbidden ground in pursuit of the laird's fish and game. That's the further link between natural childhood, in quotation marks, natural, and wartime. The Highland maze and the trench maze, both landscapes of danger. The novel gives a twist this way to the Wordsworthian reminiscence of nature having nurtured the boy alike by beauty and by fear. Well, the step-by-step unfolding of the cumulative power, complexity of environmental memory dramatizes that what we call self extends beyond skin, to quote Linda Hogan once more. That's a view especially ascribed to First Peoples, not settler cultures, but I am convinced much more widely shared, at least among those for whom place-based living has been a lived reality. Telling that Hogan prefaces that remark with a quotation to the same effect from a white South African environmental writer, Lawrence Vanderpost. The environments so early imprinted as to condition imagined personhood needn't be anything like pristinely natural. The Grenadian American poet Audre Lorde told environmental psychologist Louise Chawla that her own special places from childhood were first a spot by the edge of the Harlem River and then a tiny park attached to an urban redevelopment project, of which the latter, she says, that place, the green, the trees, and the water formed my forest of Arden. I would write about beautiful scenes. It was the only green place I ever saw. I will never forget, after my first book, some student said, "Miss Lorde, would you call yourself a nature poet?" And I thought, "What? Me?" And then I realized how wedded to these images I was. And they came from this pocket park. In the post-Rachel Carson era, landscapes of despoilation and toxicity increasingly get held up as environmental memories paradigm scenes. And here, memory may function even more readily as a carrier and reinforcer of negative emotions, of course, anxiety, despair, when a person stops to think that what we drink, inhale, and find to eat in the environment external to ourselves quickly becomes our internal environment too. That's from one text of the sort. But that doesn't mean that a damaged environment will be felt as any less valued, any less intimately bound up with one's sense of personhood. Another cancer survivor narrative that showcases this is Body Toxic, an environmental memoir by Suzanne Antoinette, a writer of Italo-Barbadian background who spent a good bit of girlhood near Toms River, New Jersey, in a marshland district sandwiched between upscale seashore properties and downscale inland pine barrens that suffered, still does, from some of the worst industrial pollution anywhere in the U.S. I have malformed reproductive organs, tumors, weird botched pregnancies, and more. And as it turns out, my five female cousins, who as teenagers made iron honor roll and ironed their hair and learned cheers, fall apart in as many intricate ways. As children, even in the womb, we were changed, charged, and reformed by the landscape. I may have pummeled away at my central nervous system and organs and drifts of ganglia. Here she's talking about her ex-druggy life. But what did it was the small white fish and the blackberries and the air itself. We loved things that soaked and flooded or seared and burned and wizened, smallish and spindly needled pines, white cedars here and there, ash, a sparse tree line, and brackish water, so weedy it looked like a cauldron of wigs. Well, I'm struck here by the fusion of perky sprightliness with grief work. She can't celebrate childhood rural romps without ruining after effects. But she won't let the afterbite poison exuberance at environmental memory's role in constituting personhood. Okay, the skittery collage approach here, hopping from memory bit to memory bit, deserves stressing itself versus the steadier gazes of Matthews, Thoreau, and Gunn. All three, even Antoinette some, more or less succumb to what Paul Ricoeur calls the pitfall of the imaginary, the assumption that memory must represent itself as image. This putting into images, bordering on the hallucinatory, he warns, constitutes a sort of weakness, a discredit, a loss of reliability for memory. Well, I wouldn't go that far myself, but still, in the passage is just quoted, distillation does stand in for a true mimesis of memory, both as residual and as process. They underrepresent not only memory's preconscious dynamics and ultimate ineffability, which no linguistic crystallization can capture, but also a number of other processes that it can. How environmental memory can get thin, fragmented, disowned, repressed, even faked. Subtilizations like these are on display in Masuji Ibuse's haunting Hiroshima novel, Black Rain, from the late 60s, which turns on dutiful middle-class Uncle Shigematsu's desire to discharge his duty as he sees it by arranging a decent marriage for the niece for whom he's assumed responsibility when he took her into his household and got employment for her at the nearby textile factory where he works. In the face, arranging marriage in the face of rumors that are circulating a half dozen years later that she's a surefire candidate for radiation sickness, whether she looks it or not. At the book's core is a series of diaries and memoirs Shigematsu gathers, his wife's, his niece Yasuko, and other informants near and distant, gathers to prove to the go-between that he himself, who became only slightly ill, was much more heavily exposed to fallout than Yasuko, who was barely sprinkled by the shower of black rain. Of course, she really is ill. She's been concealing it for some time. And what's more, Shigematsu, too, is in denial. Even in his seemingly exhaustive moment-by-moment journal of the fateful day and its aftermath, the coda that he adds after his niece falters shows that he's long known but refused to confront how even a number of out-of-towners died from just simply walking around in the ruins. Well, Shigematsu's and others' painstakingly obsessive yet also deeply aversive effort to recall how atomic apocalypse indelibly reshaped him and those near him involves a cornucopia of defensive evasions, lingering on detail to avoid thinking about big picture, hyper-concentration on performance of daily duty and banal social ritual, managing the grotesque and horrific by logging it as matter-of-factly as possible, indulging in mental roundabouts and digressions. One measure of the achievement here is the contrast to John Hersey's nonfiction bestseller, Hiroshima, which also takes the approach of personalizing eco-catastrophe by tracking a half dozen intertwined lifelines, but which always stays on topic, always on task, tightly controlled within a narrow tonal range by the narrative overvoice, versus Ibuse's more obliquely insinuating approach, dispersing focus among befuddled centers of consciousness and digressing back and forth. Black Rain makes use at one point or another, you can check me on this if you read both books, the entire set of memory malfunctions that experimental psychologist Daniel Schachter neatly sums up as the seven sins of memory. Transience, that's fading over time, absent-mindedness, blocking, misattribution, suggestibility, bias, and above all, persistence, dogged adherence to simplistic interpretation of the event. And in so doing, anticipate Schachter's follow-up argument that these memory failures can also be defended as adaptations necessary in some sense for survival. Whereas Hiroshima, Hersey's book, isn't much invested in memory psychology at all, but rather in reconstructing what's happened to the various figures that are being tracked. Part three. I don't know if that's a signal to me or something. Environmental imagination as collective memory work. The contrast between these two Hiroshima texts follows largely from difference in choice as to the relative importance of individual as against collective or social memory. In part two, I mostly talked about books centered on a single persona or actor and how environmental memory defines personhood there. But even texts so idiosyncratic as Walden and Matthew's Talking to the Moon treat individual experience as incipiently representative, as social witness. And for Black Rain, and especially Hiroshima, narrative of community is much more the central project in terms of which the individual figures get invented. That Hiroshima is much more collectivist, but not antithetically so, also shows how those alternatives montage characteristically, as well as how reinvention of the same environmental phenomenon as rendition of collective memory is bound to vary according to the authorial observer's own context. Black Rain could only have been imagined by a cultural insider. Hersey's dramatis personae, just to take one index, mark him indelibly as outsider. So many of the characters are linked to Christian mission work or otherwise brought into contact with the occupying power. Some of you doubtless know at least as much as I about the debate within memory studies as to whether memory is better understood using an individual or a social model. The social theorist who first put the concept of collective memory into circulation, Maurice Halbwachs, threw down a gauntlet on the one side, claiming that no recollections can be said to be purely interior, that is, preserved only within individual memory. And against this, it's been argued that the concept of collective memory rests on mystical transpositions of individual psychological phenomena into imaginary collectivities that at worst reinforce a kind of reactionary tribalism or reduce singulars to herd-like collectives. Well, I'm not going to go there any further. My own view is the middle ground position that's articulated by anthropologists Paul Ansa and Michael Lambeck in, I think, a fine collection of essays on trauma and memory from the mid-90s. Personal memory is always connected to social narrative, as is social memory to the personal. The self and the community are the imagined products of a continuous process. I think that's very sensible, even if it's not glamorous. This does seem close to an iron rule for single-authored works of modern literature, at least. On the one hand, even a collective documentary like Herzi's is one author's fabrication. On the other hand, even uniquely idiosyncratic reminiscences like Proust's of the tea time event that triggered his epic fiction of memory retrieval, and Ben Franklin's imagining his future wife's reaction to glancing out her genteel window upon an impecunious teenage runaway eating his roll in a Philadelphia street, are in some sense socially conditioned gestures recalling behaviors themselves socially conditioned. Still, as with those Hiroshima texts, different texts can be placed on a continuum of some sort from the personal to the social. Well, both the Hiroshima books sit at the edges of a subgenre of environmental, collective environmental memory work with long roots, but particularly salient with the acceleration and spread of rapid, large-scale environmental change. And that is the memorial reconstruction of the endangered or obliterated place-based community. The first instance in the English canon I can think of, and correct me if I'm wrong, is from the late 1700s, Oliver Goldsmith's descriptive elegy, The Deserted Village, which laments depopulation of the English countryside wrought by squirearchical enclosure. A striking example from the late colonial era is Indo-Anglian novelist Raja Rao's Kantapura, which recreates the geography, rituals, and social texture of a small town violently dispersed for resistance to the Raj in the form of a simulated Shtala Purana, a legendary history of local place, as Rao defines the genre, related by an old woman acting as community storyteller to an audience from the village that's taken her in. Kantapura also has an autobiographical subtext. So Rao said, he wrote it in exile both as an act of revolutionary partisanship and in compensation for his own displacement. So too with Native American novelist Leslie Silko's Ceremony, a work of imagined communal reconstitution, in which Silko, like Rao, described as in part a recreation of the home place from far away. Its plot turns on the slow healing of a World War II damaged GI discharged from a veterans hospital to return to the reservation where he grew up. The protagonist Teo's path to cure requires a series of increasingly complex and portentous rituals of reimmersion, during which the fragmented memories that haunt him gradually congeal around an awakened, maturer sense of belonging that's not only centripetal, but also global, subsuming, for instance, his traumatized memories of soldiering in the Pacific into a transnational solidarity sense that recognizes Japanese as kindred, as in prehistory they were. Whereas Kantapura resonantly memorializes a status quo ante and then has it unravel in the face of political and economic macro forces aggravating existing intra-community tensions. Ceremony reassembles environmental memory, transforming it from psychically destructive force in Teo's initially alienated phase inducing mental chaos, guilt, dissociation from community, desire for self-annihilation, into a solidifier of inner well-being. As with the Western Apache placemaking that anthropologist Keith Basso records in his book, Wisdom Sits in Places, key to this recentering process is a sense of landscape as shared chronotope, to use a Bakhtinian term, a socially shared timescape where every niche and place name has symbolic significance encoded in a body of stories. Relative to Rao, Silco, her plot, is much more protagonist-centric. Yet at every stage, Teo's odyssey is generalized, much more so than Ibusei's Shigematsu, as the representative of a wounded generational cohort whose collective survival symbolically hinges on his, and also as a mythic figure, synthesized not only from traditional Lacuna tales, but also syncretic, drawing most notably on the Fisher King fertility myth of redemption of land and monarch cursed by dryness and infertility, adapted by T.S. Eliot for The Wasteland from Fraser's Golden Bough and Jesse Weston's Ritual to Romance. So ceremony like Cantapara is really at bottom more a work of eco-cultural imagination than either the veiled autobiography or coming-of-age novel it might seem to be. Such narratives of restoration or obliteration of endangered place-based communities, ecosystem people, as God, Gill, and Guha call them in their environmental history of India. Narratives like these have been especially compelling for what right now seems the most dynamic single area of eco-critical work, and that's environmental justice criticism. And understandably so, given their focus on witness narratives by ecosystem people, both written and oral, as evidencing what post-Foucauldian theory has come to call counter-memory, and Lipsitz's redefinition of the term as attempted subversion of orthodox understandings by invoking localized experiences with oppression to reframe and refocus dominant narratives purporting to be universal. Environmental Justice Criticism's project is to recuperate the narrative voices of the environmentally disempowered. Whether this be a poor African-American neighborhood in Cleveland displaced by redevelopment, an Australian Aboriginal tribe fighting big uranium, the agony of the Niger Delta against both Shell Oil and their own central government, or the ad hoc community of Boston homeless. I've seen a very interesting piece of narrative ethnography on that. I don't mean to imply that collective environmental memory literature only deals with marginal groups, just that it's the most dramatic case, this is the most dramatic case of memory retrieval trying to restore what standard accounts omit. Nor would I imply that environmental justice criticism must always preach melodramas of big white guy villains versus little non-white guy victims, though that's been a characteristic tilt to date. A barometer of how this area is sophisticating, as I think it must, is a recent book, 2006, Jake Kosak's Understories, The Political Life of Forest in Northern New Mexico. Really fine work of environmental rhetoric studies that takes a basically pro-Hispano perspective, but also counterpoints Native American and Radical Green, along with Forest Service voices, to give a sense of the Rashomon-like contestedness of bioregional memory in that place, which it tries to sort out, but it doesn't come to reductive conclusions about. Four, finally, closing inferences. As this Understories account makes clear, environmental memory is not inherently an unmixed good. There are good reasons for skepticism. First, it's clearly impossible to remember everything. And Teo's guru in ceremony says, remember everything. Well, yeah, right. And even if we could, we'd be like Borges' character, Funes the Memorious, whose prodigious memory makes him hopelessly dysfunctional. Then, too, some memories are arguably best repressed. to which environmental writing also sometimes witnesses, like Sally Carragher's remarkable memoir, Home to the Wilderness, which recounts turning to natural history pursuits partly in refuge against a Gothic home life as unwanted daughter of a mother who had tried to kill her. Some element of agreed upon forgetting or break on memory work is needed for interpersonal forgiveness, and at the societal level to achieve truces, amnesties, social healing. Kosek's understory stresses that one of the ongoing sources of contention over rightful ownership and future in northern New Mexico is between Chicano dating of environmental injustice back to Anglo conquest and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo versus Native American dating it back to Spanish conquest 2.5 centuries before that. Memories, especially of old wounds, can freeze individuals and whole societies in a state of melancholia, no doubt about it. In the second place, as paleobiologist Jared Diamond observes, like history itself, environmental memory can mislead even when it's right, can seduce you into suicidal behavior when you go by what worked in the past but doesn't anymore. Third, what environmental memory straddles, the fact that environmental memory straddles between truth and myth opens it up to forms of wishfulness, like the unkillable myth of the so-called ecological Indian, the idealization of a pre-contact primordium that never was, or possible abuse and potentially endless wrangling, as with the controversy over the claims in Nobel laureate Rigoberta Menchú's As Told to autobiography, I, Rigoberta Menchú, personally to have suffered forms of immiseration inflicted against indigenous peasantry by Ladino land barons, military, and police that she herself didn't, although other peasants did. The temptation of commentators who've weighed in on this text to veer towards judgmentalism, either on the one side or the other, has been almost irresistible. Well, with all these types of objections in mind, but especially the last, and most especially the case of the boom in Holocaust memorialization, historian Charles Mayer diagnoses a contemporary pathology of memory surfeit, as he calls it, which he takes as signaling a retreat from transformative politics into retrograde ethnic identitarianism. That this charge has basis for scholarship as well as public culture seems clear from the work that memory historians most often cite as the seminal text in modern memory stories that bear on the environmental. That's the multi-volume Lieu de Mémoire, or Memory Sites, compiled by French cultural historian Pierre Nora. Often criticized, justly, I think, as suffused with nostalgia for an organic sense of Frenchness modernity has lost. Indeed, Nora explicitly describes his project as the upshot of the tragic fall into modernity, distinguishing between what he calls true memory, which today subsists only in gestures and habits, unspoken craft traditions, intimate physical knowledge, ingrained reminiscences and spontaneous reflexes, versus memory transformed by its passage through history, which is practically the opposite: willful and deliberate, psychological, individual, and subjective, rather than social, collective, and all-embracing. Well, enough of negative. Despite all that could be said against it, environmental memory, both collective and personal, has positive uses that can't be denied. It could be put to strategic advantage by the disempowered, indeed by all social actors, as the Rigoberta Menchú case also shows. Second, environmental memory is a powerful social reality, crucial to well-being for many, if not all. An emergency physician friend of mine who's volunteered all over the world for Doctors Without Borders and other agencies told me that she and her colleagues working with refugees in post-conflict situations have found that environmental loss often rankles worse even than human loss. One study of displaced Palestinian communities sums this up quite poignantly. The village, with its special arrangements of houses and orchards, its open meeting places, its burial ground, its collective identity, was built into the personality of each villager to a degree that made separation like an obliteration of the self. 30 years after the uprooting, the older generation still mourns. For sure, such reported memories are liable to after-the-fact fictive reshaping through collective socialization, personal wish fulfillment. And the same holds for at least some of the writers that I've quoted from, Thoreau, Gunn, Antonella, Silko, maybe those especially. But that doesn't undermine the previous point about the power of the environmental memory imprint as energizer, whether the effect be to undermine, lift up, traumatize, or all of the three. Finally, and arguably most crucial to world citizenship now, environmental memory corrects against the hallucination of human autonomy, both of the individual and the species, a bias reinforced both psychologically by the parallax that comes with our neurobiological equipment of seeming to live only in the present moment, and socially by 2 centuries of techno-industrial change. Any such correction can't guarantee, but it can help make possible a greater internalized self-consciousness and collective awareness than presently exists of humans having evolved over time within environmental contexts likely to continue to shape us more than we shape them. An awareness indispensable for fueling active desire to keep the planet habitable. The fact that an increasing percentage of humans, even in the so-called developing world, are not themselves ecosystem people, don't live traditional place-based lives, and don't therefore have access to the environmental markers and attendant social rituals that Pierre Nora fondly recalls and Roger Rao's and Leslie Silko's sympathetic characters find key to personal and social being, makes the search for renewed visions of environmental belonging, at once past conscious and future directed, all the more needful. The arts of environmental imagination are a great resource here. Potential activators of the sense of interdependence between the who and the where of existence that in itself is anything but fictive, on which we turn our back at peril of denying a part of ourselves that, when also denied by enough others, threatens to put both us and our environment out of commission for good. Thank you. Thank
you. You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.